Welcome into another edition of the Data and Victory Podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. As always, I'm joined by Dan. And Dan, for this 53rd edition, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow. But not only that, for this 53rd edition, we are bringing in probably the greatest number 53 of all time to come through the Xavier program, in one Ryan Caldwell. Rhino, how are you doing, buddy? Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Everything's going well right now. It's a hot summer day.
All right. Well, Ryan, you played at Xavier 99 to 2003, right? What update the fans. What have you been doing since then? What are you up to now?
Since then, I was in the financial business for a while. Now we're for Clear Channel Cincinnati. So with the FM properties, so KISS 107 and WEBN. But I live in Northern Kentucky, and I have a wife and a little boy.
See that? He's an 859 guy. That's because Kentucky is better than Cincinnati.
Hey, Rick, hold it down. Thing is, I still represent the 513 number, though. I don't do the 859 number stuff. That's not my idea right there.
Shut up, Caldwell.
I say true to the higher roots in the Cincinnati 513 area.
Ryan, take us back to your playing days here a little bit. You played with maybe the greatest Musketeer at Xavier history, if not certainly one of them, in David West. What's your best David West story for us?
I got plenty. I will say this much. He is one of the most competitive people I've played against or played with my whole life. And there was times in practice he'd be so competitive where he would get in fist fights with the younger players because they try to come at him and he won't take their stuff. And so there have been a couple times he could throw a couple punches here and there. But David, he's just a competitor. But probably the best story I have is one year we had a new when Dad Mata came in, we had a legendary basketball operations guy named Dollar Bill Kilmore, who's a legend, as Bryce knows who he is. And one day we're in there, and Kilmore's new on the job, came from Dayton, so of course David and Liz didn't really like Kilmore that much already. And we requested something, and Kilmore goes, "I don't know." And David goes, "Bill Kilmore, do you know who I am? I'm David West. Two-time AHN player of the year. I should be able to get what I want right now." So after that moment, Kilmore sort of goes, "Okay, I understand the program. We're going to do by your way, David."
Hey, Ryan, you were there the same 4 years as David West, so you got to see kind of his development as a player from starting out with that first team with Skip and then all the way through to when he was Sporting News National Player of the Year, AP National Player of the Year, his senior year. What was that development like? Because when he came in, I remember him being pretty good his freshman year. I think he had that famous strip of Kenyon Martin at the end of the shootout that year. And he had some big games that season. And he went head-to-head with, I think, Troy Murphy in the NIT that year for Notre Dame.
Yep.
But can you talk a little bit about his development over the 4 years leading into the NBA draft?
Yeah, that's my issue. I think our freshman year, he came in probably, and people say I'm lying, he probably came in at 180 pounds at 6'8". And my body came in probably about 6'5", 220, let alone he had 4 inches on me. The thing about David, like, you guys ever shook his hands before, he has the biggest hands possible. So he always had good hands. But as the years went on, I think the first 2 years with Skip, Skip always encouraged David, and that's always got better. And when Thad came in, just kept on encouraging him, "Hey, be more of a player. Be willing to shoot a jump shot." Because one thing about David, he was always unselfish his first couple years. He always wanted to give the ball to Romaine or Lyle with him some more. But as the time went on, I think he realized how dominant he was. And he had to face that 1 year. He can put it on him best with anybody. So as years went on, his skill level got better, but the thing behind it, his whole worth it every year got better and better.
To add on to what Rhino said real quick, you know, I'm 5'9", but I got pretty good hands. I can pretty big hands. I can palm a basketball. Shaking David West's hand is one of the most emasculating things ever. you just don't want to do it.
I think one time a regular ruler fit from Dave's thumb. If he spread out his hand, a ruler would fit between his thumb and his pinky finger.
It's just not good. But Rhino, you're clearly the greatest walk-on in the history of Xavier basketball. And I don't think your contribution will ever be topped.
Yeah.
You know, talk about what your role was on the team, both on the court and off the court.
on the court, I was sort of like the back in the prime. I was like a
bucket getter.
I was a Flavor Flav type person. I was more the hype person for the team. So everything went to the cold clock. I was the hype guy. I tried to get everyone motivated to play. And before games, I was in the huddle. Probably I didn't know what I was saying, but I'd get everyone hyped up. But off the court, I thought I'd be a leader, but also at least I have a good time off the court. For you people who don't know, my jersey is retired at Dana Gardens. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but but the whole experience there, like I knew it was my situation. Well, I wasn't going to play much, but I knew I could contribute during practice and off the court and locker room, try to be a leader. But on the court, I just knew I had a fun time and try to light guys up during practice if I can start shooting the ball over them.
It doesn't matter where your jersey's retired. It just matters that it's retired, Ryan. That is the goal. You said, you know, your role was more of a hype man, but take us back to January 14th at the Cintas Center. I'm assuming you remember this night, an 80-47 win over Temple. You came onto the court and absolutely exploded for 5 points, including a three, a rebound, and a blocked shot in just 3 minutes of action. What got into you that night?
I felt like sort of Kobe that night. I got off real quick. And it's funny because when I came off the court, Coach Miller, because I was an assistant, goes, what's your deal today? I was like, you guys have been holding me back too much for practice and game. I was like, you see what happens when he put me in for a couple minutes? I get a black shot. I'll drill one for 35 feet for you from the Cintas logo. I was like, I just need more touches.
True or false, real quick, Ryan, you shot more three-pointers than two-pointers in your senior year. What do you think?
I think true.
That is true. You shot 6 threes and 5 twos in your senior year. How about that?
Yeah, but I also think if someone else told me down the road, my whole career is there. I was 1,000% from the foul line.
Wow. Impressive.
Yeah.
So we would describe you as a power two guard?
I'll look to be a power two or a power three. I'm sort of like a Barkley type body, just without the bigger backside and without his jumping ability. But other than that, yeah, I think I can shoot better at Barkley. I'm a power two.
Hey, Ryan, during your career, one of the big, you know, maybe one of the biggest events in Xavier history up until the Big East move was the opening of the Cintas Center. And that happened during your career. Can you just, do you have any recollections or things that you remember about that transition? And, you know, maybe the first time you guys walked in there to check out the facilities and so forth, what you were thinking at that point?
Oh yeah, it was unreal. It's my, growing up at Kid of Cincinnati, always thought they were younger. Always went to the Cincinnati Gardens. So, like, man, this place is pretty cool. But when I started, like, my freshman year of college, I was like, man, this place is really a dump. Then when they started building Cintas Center, they get some tours. Then you're like, man, this place is unreal. Especially when you see all the other places they attend. So you see, like, a Sal who plays in a barn. Fordham, I think, well, he still believes I have the oldest gym in the country, which is it's horrendous. But you see all these average facilities, and you go to the Cintas Center, you're like, oh my. Yeah, plus, the first game of the year, we played Miami, Ohio. I mean, we beat them pretty good. But, yeah, the Cintas Center, you can't say anymore. It's 2 minutes from where we live down on campus. It's a walk across the street. Everything is in-house for you. And I was just down a couple weeks ago, and that place keeps on changing and getting better. So that's a great place to play at.
Well, Ryan, we appreciate all your time. Before we let you go real quick, I know you still keep up with the team. What are you most excited about with we got six newcomers, freshmen coming in this year, Xavier. Who are you most excited to watch play this year?
To be honest with you, I'm really excited with everyone they have coming in. The one person I'm really excited to see play is Will Remy Abel, a transfer from IU. I'm happy he didn't get hurt in the summer league a couple weeks ago, but I'm really excited to see him play. Also really excited to see the point guard from Michigan play.
Yeah,
so I think he'll be a good fit. Yeah, he's really good. Of course, you have the other kid from Trayvon from Indiana who's pretty damn good also. So I'm excited to see all of them play, but there's probably the most three I like to see play most.
Rhino, you've had a lot of honors in your life. Is having your own Dana and Victory podcast probably the greatest?
It's probably number two. I'm not going to lie. Having my jersey retired at Dana Gardens is probably number one. That's hard to beat.
Hey, Ryan, does BJ give you a break on drinks there because you got the jersey on the ceiling, or is it or do you still have to pay full freight?
I think I still have to pay full freight, but back in my prime, I was able to get discount drinks. A beer and a burger for a dollar back in my prime.
Nice, I'll take that.
Yeah. Well, all guys, right. I appreciate you having me on, and Snowball, stay out of trouble, and Rick, good talking to you, man.
All right, he is Ryan Caldwell, one of the greatest walk-ons and certainly the greatest number 53 in Xavier history. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right. Well, great to talk with Ryan Caldwell. I'm glad you mentioned that scoring outburst against Temple, Rick, because that was also a big topic of discussion when we had Joe Hughes on, if you remember.
That's
his,
right.
His like 8-point effort against Fordham his senior year when he just got on the court and turned into Adam Morrison for a minute and a half. But anyway, fellas, I think we want to move on. There's a few things to discuss, although as we always say during the summer, it's a little bit hit or miss. But I know that both you guys have made your way down to Woodward to watch the City Gear Summer League. We still call it the Devereaux League, I guess. And was hoping you could each weigh in on what you've seen from each of the freshmen and how they look compared to what you were expecting when they show up on campus. So why don't we start off? Let's start off with Edmund Sumner, because I think that's been he's been the biggest topic of conversation over the last couple of weeks. Snow, your take on Sumner after with what you've seen from him this summer?
Well, full disclosure, you know, didn't see Sumner in his one summer league appearance. However, been talking to people, and you know, I didn't get a chance to see Sumner live this winter because of 9 different snowstorms and one of his sprained ankles. So I had to rely on tape, which is something I hate doing. And he has a tape against Josh Jackson of Detroit Consortium, who's, you know, number one or number two player in the 2016 class. And it was the most impressive tape I saw all year from a kid. That said, you know, he didn't quite replicate it in a couple other games that I saw. But I mean, I knew it was there, but I question, you know, this kid needs to get stronger, all this other stuff. And, you know, I had someone close to the program tell me, you know, man, Trayvon's going to start for us, but I'm not even sure he's our best freshman right now. And he was referring to Sumner. I mean, he's really proven himself so far. And I know the staff's been very impressed, and, you know, the fellow players have been very impressed, which is saying something.
Well, I guess one thing we should say is obviously you all know this is summer league. We're talking about a couple of views. I've seen each of these guys play maybe 1 to 3 summer league games at the very most so far. Three summer league games at the very most so far. And then I've seen them run open gym twice. So it's not exactly like this means a whole lot, but there's nothing else to talk about at the beginning of July here. So this is what we do with Edmund. Since he's arrived on campus, the one thing, I mean, I was really high on him coming in, as a lot of you know. The one thing that's really stuck out to me already is I think everyone was concerned how much is his weight or his lack of weight going to be a hindrance to playing at this level. And the one thing I've seen is just that, one, he has all the moves off the dribble, and two, his athleticism has made it to where his weight and lack of strength is certainly a factor, but it doesn't seem to be nearly as big of a factor as you might have thought coming in, considering how skinny he is. I mean, he is a legit 6'4", so his height and length really help him in that regard, and just all the moves and athleticism that he's able to use on the offensive end really kind of keeps defenders from getting too physical with him and knocking him off kilter. Now, it'll be great when he adds strength, but like Snow said, he's been very impressive so far.
All right, so moving past Sumner, and we'll double back to him during the next segment, but let's talk a little bit about Trayvon Blewett. I think he's sort of the most known quantity coming in. Thoughts on him so far this summer? We'll start with Rick this time.
Yeah, the one thing about Trayvon, I mean, what else are you going to say? Because we've been kind of gushing over him his entire high school and AAU career, and since Xavier picked him up, his commitment. I think the big thing that I've noticed about him is, one, he's really big. I mean, I knew he was big, but seeing him in a college gym, in open gym next to all these other guys, you're like, I mean, he's a legit 6'6" and a thick chested guy. I mean, he can really hold his own even when it comes to banging down on the blocks for rebounds and stuff with guys who are 2-3 years already into a college weight program. The other thing I've really liked that I've seen from him already is, okay, yeah, you're a big-time scorer in high school, but do you keep that same exact mentality? Do you play the same game once you get in the gym with all these established college players? And there's no question. I mean, he has been just as aggressive as not even more since he's arrived on campus.
Snow?
Yeah. I mean, with Trayvon, like, he could be on the floor in the game between the Heat and the Spurs, and if you ask Trayvon, he's going to tell you he's the best player on the court. Yes. So, you know, confidence against college kids isn't going to be an issue. And don't get that twisted. He's a great kid off the court, you know, just tremendous kid. But on the court, and this is a glowing compliment, he thinks he's the best player on the planet. So, you know, I knew he'd come in and step right in and make an impression on people. I mean, he's so good, and he's such a good shooter and scorer, but people don't realize he has such a high IQ. And now that he's in really good shape, him and his dad have been working out feverishly the last 2 years to change his body from a kid who, you know, when I first saw him as a freshman, he took the opening tip and jumped like 2 centimeters off the court. And at that point in my brilliance, I wrote him off as a prospect. Good work, Snow. And things have changed a little bit, obviously. And, you know, so he's been working really hard, and, you know, he's already going to step in the weight room. And while he's not going to be, you know, a guy like, you know, Jalen Reynolds quite yet, you know, in the weight room, he's going to more than hold his own.
All right. Mackende London is a guy who actually played more at the Devereaux League than some of his compatriots in the class. Rick, your thoughts on Mackende so far? I know he had one game where he was extremely effective, scored like 20 and 10, and then had one game where he appeared to not be able to hit the broadside of a barn. What are you seeing from him so far? And maybe you can weigh in. I'll get both you guys to weigh in on the whole question of the red shirt, which has been a topic that's been discussed a little bit on the message board.
Yeah, well, the thing with Mackende is he's one that I didn't get to see. I mean, I saw a tape of him and I saw him playing on ESPN and everything, but he's a guy that I didn't get to see a lot live before he committed to Xavier. And the word to use would just be intriguing. I haven't seen too, quite simply because there just aren't many guys like him. When you're talking about, he's a legit 6'9", 6'10". They measured him back to back with James Farr, and he was slightly taller than James Farr when he arrived on campus, which, I mean, I didn't expect him to be quite that tall, and he's even longer than he is tall. And he's a good athlete too. So all of that wrapped up into a skill, wrapped up into a body with a skill set of being able to handle and being agile and really shooting the ball well from the outside makes him just a very unusual prospect. So I'm excited to see what he brings, but obviously, like we've talked about, he does not go inside very much at all. He is basically a wing. So when I look at him, what I think is, you hope he turns into a Justin Dolman type mentality where he'll be willing to go in and rebound and defend, but you allow him to face up and shoot threes on offense.
Yeah, I mean, getting to that, you know, Justin Dolman, you know, that was a different time in the internet back then in terms of scouting. I don't think anyone knew quite how good he was. I mean, this dude was just named the MVP in the second best league in the world. He might be one of the top 60, 70 players in the world playing basketball right now.
Yeah, but that being said, I played against him in high school and he was terrible. I mean, he was very soft and he was strictly a shooter that wanted to jack threes the whole game.
And he even wasn't that great a shooter.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, everybody from Griffin McKenzie to Josh Duncan to anyone else who's tall and can kind of shoot gets compared to Dolman. But Mackende London actually has a Dolman skill set. He's a tall kid with guard skills. Now, that means, you know, in Xavier lore, that means you get compared to Dolman. In the national lore, that means you're the next Kevin Durant, which makes me angry. But, you know, this is a kid who I think has the chance just to be spectacular. Some kids are ranked based on, you know, their production and their Trayvon, and we know they're going to come in and be a stud. Some kids are ranked on, man, down the road, this kid could be a star. And Mackende fits the latter portion. With that, to me, if Xavier can, now they're not going to force him to redshirt, but you've got 13 eligible bodies right now. Now, I don't know if you're a math major or not, but 200 minutes into 13 bodies, that's not a lot to go around. So you can't play 13. You can't play 12. You realistically can't play 11. And if all 13 are eligible to play, someone's going to have to redshirt. And to me, Mackinday is that guy, because even if he wouldn't stay around for his fifth year like Derrick Brown, like a situation like with Derrick Brown where Xavier had him for 4 years but only played for three, Xavier still benefited more, and so did Derrick, by having the year to just lift weights as a freshman and get better that way and not have to make – he was allowed to lift like it's an off season during the season because he didn't have to play. So he wasn't just trying to maintain. He was trying to add. And I think that's something that Mackinday could really benefit from, and even Xavier would benefit from, even if they didn't get that fifth year out of him.
Yeah, sure. And I think at this point, you look at him, and to me, it'd be really hard for him to contribute right away this year. At least, put it this way, if he had to, I don't think Xavier would be in a great spot. I think it would mean that someone got hurt or someone really wasn't living up to what they should be on the court. That being said, I think, Snow, you mentioned this on the message board. I think it's dead on. The Brazil trip is really going to be telling for Mackinday.
Oh, no question. I mean, like, you know, I don't know exactly, you know, I'm sure Xavier's going to play to win there, but at the same time, they're going to play to see what they have. And I think that's far more important to them. And I think that's what's going to really determine playing time for a lot of these guys, whether it's Brandon Randolph versus Larry Austin, whether it's Cam Mackinday getting on the floor. Is Edmund Sumner so good that we can't redshirt him? Kind of like Michigan found out with Caris LeVert. You know, they wanted to redshirt Caris LeVert. Then they're like, there's just no way. We can't keep him off the court. You know, what do you do with Trayvon and JP? Can they play together? Do they fit together? How does it all work? So there's a lot to be diagnosed in Brazil with this team.
Well, I think somewhere Snow, Brian Gregory heard you say you can't play with 11. He's like, damn, that's what I had wrong. So you mentioned JP McCura, another guy like Trayvon a little bit in that I think people kind of talked about him being more of a college ready guy. Is that what you've seen in open gyms? Let's start or open gyms in summer league. I know I think he only played one game in the summer league, so this may be an unfair question. Well, start with you, Rick. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, one of the things with the JP, I'd say it's similar to Trayvon. You know, Snow said the thing about him, Trayvon feeling like he's the best player in the gym. If Trayvon feels that way, I'd guarantee you JP feels that way maybe times two. The thing that's really stood out about him is he has an attitude, he has some confidence, and he's a good athlete. And that's kind of what I've taken away. He's been very aggressive. Open gym was a lot more telling than that one summer league game is where he kind of got benched in the second half. But in open gym, he's very, very aggressive, really likes to get to the rim. And no doubt he's going at Trayvon's throat and vice versa, which has been great. Those two matched up every day, I think, is going to be a great thing for this team going forward as far as practices go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, JP, he's got a little asshole to him, and I say that in a complimentary way because, well, that describes me as well. And you know, he knows he's better than dudes who are playing ahead of him in the summer league, so he was not going to be afraid to tell the coach, like, dude, I go to Xavier, he goes to Cincinnati State, stop.
And the absurdity, and I think his actual coaches are I have been documented before. I mean, this is not a high level of coaching. This is not, you know, Pop and Spolstra matching wits on the sideline.
No, I think the actual quote was no one came to see the JUCO All-Stars, which was awesome, by the way.
So, but you know, JP will be fine. What's funny is I've talked to some other coaches recently and, you know, they'll ask me like, how the Butler freshman doing? How the Xavier freshman doing? What are you hearing about? And, you know, I've had a few coaches tell me they think JP's a pro. And I'm like, ooh, relax, fellas. But, you know, like there's some people that are higher on him than I am that think, you know, he's going to be really, really good from day one.
So we talked about, so I think we've got two left now. Sean O'Mara, interesting prospect. I think there was a lot of, it seems like a guy that flew under the radar, but just produced as a high school player, not particularly highly ranked. But where do you guys stand on him? Is this a guy that's going to be able to step into big man rotation minutes from day one?
Well, I think that's probably something we'll talk about in the next segment a little more as far as where he fits in the rotation. But I'd say my initial impressions of him are one, that he's strong and his body's in a little bit better shape than I expected it to be. And two, I really like what he's shown with his face up game in open gym. He passes the ball well facing the basket, and he was automatic in both open gyms that I've seen him shooting that mid range 12 to 15 foot jump shot. And that's going to be really big for him scoring, I think. That being said, there's still a long way to go, and it's going to be really interesting when he gets into more practices and learning the defensive rotations. How quick is he to pick up all of that stuff is going to be a big question for him, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like with Sean, I think he's a kid who's going to have a small role as a freshman, and that's just because, once again, there's 120 minutes at the power forward position. Jalen Reynolds will be determined by how many fouls he picks up. Let's say he can play 25. Stainbrook's going to be 25 to 30. Jimmy's going to get most of the remaining minutes. So, you know, what's there left for either one guy to slide down to the power forward position, McKinday to get some minutes, or Sean to get some minutes? There's just not many left. Now, when Stainbrook moves on, I think you'll see Sean be a solid contributor. He's not going to be a kid who plays in the NBA. But he can be a very strong low post guy who provides passing and rebounding.
So finally, we come to Larry Austin, the sort of late arriving member of the class. Snow, your scouting report, I read a couple of your scouting reports on him before he arrived, and your take on him seemed to be this guy can be a high level defender, but his offensive game is pretty far away. What have you seen anything to change that, or is that still basically where you are with Larry Austin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I mean, he can guard. He's a heck of an athlete. He's tough. I don't think he makes decisions with the ball real well, and he certainly doesn't shoot it well. So what's going to be interesting with him is to see how that all breaks down. But I don't think offensively he's going to be much of a factor for at least a couple years. But he can play a role just by pressuring the ball and, you know, being athletic and tough and just stealing a few minutes that way.
My first thoughts were, one, he's bigger than I thought. I mean, I knew he wasn't. He's definitely not a big guard, but he's also not a sub-6-foot guy who's going to really struggle because he's small. Like a lot of people talked about with D. Davis, that combined with the fact that Snow mentioned he's a very good athlete is going to kind of make that a non-factor. The one thing I do kind of wonder when I look at him, Snow mentioned he's not going to be an offensive factor for a while at least. I look at him and I wonder, the one thing about him might be that he's already what he is. I look at him as a guy who kind of, I don't know how much upside he has, but right now he looks like he can play at this level. He looks ready to do what he can do, which is defend, handle the ball, and be an athlete and play in transition. He was obviously, when you get into a summer league or open gym setting where you can get out and transition a little more, he's going to excel in that game a little bit more probably than the slowdown game offensively in the half court. But I've been somewhat cautiously optimistic with what I've seen from him already, because I do think that his physical maturity allows him to play at a pretty high level and hold his own already.
Excellent. Excellent. So, Rick, before we leave the summer league situation, I want to ask you real quickly to weigh in on what you know about the severity and the prognosis with Remy Abel. I think everybody probably is aware he suffered a knee injury toward the end of a summer league game last weekend. It was it apparently was pretty ugly on site, and he had to be wheeled out of Withrow. But apparently you're hearing it's not that not that severe.
Yeah, I think what was really scary was he was on a wide open fast break. He got the ball thrown out ahead of him. No one was with him, and he was just going up for a dunk. And as soon as he went up, his I think it was his left knee gave out underneath of him, and he went down grimacing, screaming, grabbing it, and never put weight on it again before he left there. And I think that's why, in the moment, everyone looked like thought that it might be pretty bad. They say his knee is completely fine. I saw him at open gym walking around last week. He has no brace, no wrap, no nothing on it. He said he felt fine and he'll be back in like a week. He'll probably take a little more time off than that just because Flukes will make him. But he seems to be fine. And, you know, look, you mentioned some of the we talked about all the freshmen in summer league. He's been one of the guys that, you know, no one's really seen yet because he had to sit out last year other than Musketeer Madness. But he's been the guy in summer league that's been really probably the most impressive other than Jalen Reynolds so far. He had that 39-point outburst. And the one thing about his game that's been interesting to see, especially when you factor in that Xavier's lost Samaje Christen, is that he's a super aggressive driver to the rim. He's got a big, strong body. He's a good athlete with a good first step. And he kind of uses that. If you remember how Dez Wells played, Dez didn't have the jump shot that Remy does, but the way Dez kind of attacked the rim and used his shoulder to lean into guys and just attack the rim every time he caught the ball in the wing, that's kind of how Remy has been playing. He doesn't have the elite athleticism that Dez had, but he does have the jump shot that Dez didn't have. So it's going to be really interesting to see what he can provide offensively on the wing, because I do think he's got a really nice skill set and a great body for a two or even a three. If, like Snow mentioned, they end up wanting to slide one of those guys like Trayvon down to the four at times and play smaller.
I thought per, you know, Musketeer Report rules, we are no longer allowed to mention Dez Wells by name.
Oh, well.
This is the last season.
I think we're on a moratorium. That was just last year. I think we're past that now. We're
although, like, okay, actually, so. I guess with Maryland in the Big Ten now, Snow, you might get to see him play a few times live this year.
I got to see him play against Ohio State last year.
Oh, that's right. I forgot they played. Yeah. Well, so any other thoughts on returning players at the Summer League or at Open Gym from either of you guys?
Well, I mean, Jalen Reynolds has been playing on a Nerf rim for the last about month in Summer League. He looked ridiculous, but obviously the playing in an Open Gym setting isn't what worries anyone about Jalen. So it all comes down to being able to play in the structure and not pick up fouls, everything like that. The question you kind of just wonder each time you see him, I don't know, cross over a point guard, then do a spin move in the middle lane and dunk from 10 feet out, is how close is he from the light bulb going off? I mean, because he has everything you would want in an NBA 4. So how long is it going to take before it clicks and he just becomes an absolute monster? With James Farr, I would say the biggest thing I've seen with him is his confidence continuing to rise. I remember last year at the beginning of the season saying that he was not confident, didn't feel like he belonged on the court as a freshman, and it was clear. And I think that was a big reason he never got on the court. Last year, I felt like his confidence had risen to a point where he thought he belonged and he wanted to be on the court more. And at the end of the year, he wasn't happy about how it ended and he felt like he should have been playing more. So I think that's helped him. I think he has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder and I think his confidence is really high right now. I think he's going to have a big year. He's been a double-double machine in summer league. Not that that means a whole lot, but I do like the sort of the attitude he's been bringing. And then finally with Stainbrook, I would say the one thing from him is just that he looks to be in great shape and having no ill effects from that knee injury that he suffered at the end of last season.
So he's kind of the anti Joey Votto. He overcomes a knee injury.
Yeah. How about that?
All right, fellas. I think the next, wanted to have a quick discussion now, talking a little bit about storylines going into the Brazil trip and then into the sort of preseason practices. And I was hoping that each of us could sort of talk about something, maybe a playing time battle, a positional battle, or a particular player that we think is going to be something to watch over the next, say, 6 weeks or so. So, Rick, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I would say probably for this season, if we're just talking, I mean, with the
first, just for this season.
Yeah, if it's just going into this season, I'd say probably my most interesting storyline involving the freshman class would be the guard battle. Granted, JP, Trayvon, you know, you're talking about guys competing for a starting job, basically, that's going to be really important to this team, but I'm kind of confident in what those guys bring. I look at this guard battle and I see Miles Davis and Brandon Randolph, who have already played for a year and got some minutes. I mean, these aren't guys who sat on the bench and no one's expecting anything from them. You would expect those guys to make a jump forward. And then you've got Edmund Sumner and even Larry Austin. As we've been talking about the whole podcast, basically, Sumner is in a spot where he's already making it tough on people to start saying, well, where is he going to play? How many minutes is he going to get? I only expect that to increase as the summer goes on, as they go to Brazil. So I'm just wondering, especially from a standpoint of Miles Davis and Brandon Randolph, what are we going to see out of those two guys? What are they going to do? Because they have to know. They're not stupid. They see Edmund coming in and playing the way he's playing. This is a huge summer for these guys, not only for this year. I mean, it's interesting how will the minutes sort out this year, but if those guys lose these minutes this year, where does their role go from there? I mean, are they even a part of this program going forward if they don't find their role this year? I think that's going to be really interesting. It is a huge offseason for kind of the secondary guards. We know D. Davis and Remy Abel are probably going to start, but after that, it's completely up for grabs in my mind. And I mean, even Larry Austin, I think, has a chance to win a few minutes if Miles Davis and Brandon Randolph don't really impress the coaches in the offseason.
Brian?
Yeah, I mean, how the minutes are shake out is going to be very interesting. I wouldn't be shocked to see the staff kind of tell Stainbrook, like, you know, why don't you enjoy the beach here in Brazil? We're going to figure some stuff out. And, you know, play him in a fairly limited role just to see, can Makinde play? Can we play with James at the four? Can we do this? Can we do that? I think that's going to be what's interesting is, you know, like, I think D and Stainbrook might have a pretty limited role in Brazil because those are the two, you know what those two are going to do for you. And, you know, and see which one of our guards can play point guard. Is it Edmund? Is it Brandon? Is it Larry? You know, which one can play two? You know, who can guard who? And I think that's what's going to be interesting is just the mix and match of behind D and behind Stainbrook and how they decide that they can play.
Well, one of the other things on the Brazil trip, too, you mentioned kind of sitting out D and Stainbrook a little bit. One thing a lot of teams have done in the past, and I think I've heard from sources that Xavier might be considering doing this, is playing what they call a JV game, where they go out and they just play all the freshmen and probably, you know, the one-year guys, the Miles Davis, Brandon Randolph types, and give them kind of that kind of your second. The guys who aren't going to get a lot of chances to prove themselves, here's kind of your chance to show us what you can do and get some good experience in a competitive environment.
Yeah, and I think actually Mario mentioned that they were planning on doing that in the Brazil
was,
trip,
right?
Against like a second or third division team, whoever they were playing. They were going to put Stainbrook and Davis as assistant coaches or something like that and let the young guys play. I guess for me, you know, it's more of an intangible thing, and I'm going to be interested to hear, Rick, how you assess this, how Shannon assesses this during the practices leading up to Brazil, during that trip, and then when practice starts, because I'm really interested to see how the leadership dynamic shakes down for this team this year. Because last year, you know, there was a feeling, I think, around the program, especially at the beginning of the year, that, you know, with that they were finally kind of, it was a little bit more relaxed in practice, I guess. And it'll be interesting to see who emerges as a leader this year, because D. Davis, you know, he's not a vocal leader, but this is his team, as we talked about on the last podcast. I mean, he's going to be sort of he's going to be the man with the ball in his hands most of the game. So it's going to be interesting to hear how things are developing as far as internal dynamics and leadership on the team, how the coaches are responding to these guys, because obviously they're going to be doing a lot more teaching this year with all the newcomers. And with it being something else we talked about, with this finally being Chris Mack's team. I mean, all these guys are guys that he recruited, has coached their entire career. So that's going to be something that I'm looking at, as well as the personnel issues that you and Brian discussed.
Well, and it's definitely going to have to be. So, I mean, the only guy who really has any experience in this role is Matt Stainbrook. And I think that's pretty clearly who the go-to guy will be. I mean, he'll be the face that we see. He'll be the one talking to the media a lot. The other guy that will really bring something from a leadership standpoint, although I don't think he's the most outspoken, is Remy Abel. And that's more of a work ethic and bring the hard hat to practice every day type mentality that I think he'll bring will really help. The nice thing about it is, you know, you talked about it being Chris's team and him having his guys. These are pretty good kids that they've got in the program right now. The freshmen that they've brought in, you're not going to have trouble getting those guys to work hard. So in a lot of ways, I think it's kind of going to be everyone pushes each other and helps rule when it comes to getting good effort and having good practices. I don't think that's going to be an issue, but I do think when you talk about the vocal leadership, that's probably going to have to go to that's going to have to come from Stainbrook, because you're right. I mean, I don't know who else really, who else would really, it usually comes from your best players. And I mean, other than D's not going to be that guy, Remy's not really going to be that guy, because neither one of them want to talk a whole lot, it's got to be Matt.
All right, fellas, let's move on to the 2015 recruiting scene. We're getting deep into the summer of 2014. This is when a lot of these guys really show their stuff. We're starting to see some commitments fall and some decommitments actually as well. So I was wondering if each of you guys could sort of break down where you see Xavier at right now, to use some terrible grammar, how many guys you think they're going to take and who you think are the top prospects at the moment.
Well, there's not a ton to update on the 2015 class because, like we talked about before, I mean, they've only got two spots open. They may or may, I mean, chances are they'll probably use both of them. But at the same time, if things stay intact and no one leaves the program in the next year, then they could very well just take one and save another one for 2016. I get asked a lot of the things I hear at Summer League is people like, well, who are we most likely to land right now? It's not a question I like a whole lot, but it. For the sake of people wanting to know, I'd say the guy that they're probably in the best position to land or have the most advanced relationship with is Kipper Nichols. Minnesota and Maryland were the latest to offer, and probably the only other two big names along with X that have offered him so far. I think he's probably the guy right now that I'd put on top, especially after Raymond Spalding received that Louisville offer. My honest opinion is that it'll be really tough to land Spalding, and if they can, then it's probably for the wrong reasons, because other people backed off him or something. Another little bit of news here from the 2015 class is they did just offer another 7'5" guy. They had Cimbalar committed a few years ago. They just offered a 7'5" guy, and his name is Taco Elhaji Taco Fall. So they've got that going from. He's a 7'5", 270-pound center from Senegal. He plays for Each One, Teach One. They just offered him recently within the past week. So that's kind of Snow. What's your thoughts on the 2015 class?
We're going to say his full name was Taco, like he played for the Brazilian soccer team or something.
Like just one name?
Yeah, just Taco.
He just goes by Taco.
That's amazing. Would he have Taco on the back of his jersey?
I don't think so. I think it'd be Fall.
Because if
you could get a Xavier Taco authentic, you'd have one, wouldn't you?
They'd sell out. I don't know. I'm sorry, Snow. I stepped on your intro there.
All good. You know, with Taco, it's so hard, man, with those big, massive human beings to just decide what they're going to be. You know, I've had a bunch of coaches ask me about him, and I just say, listen, I don't know. Like, he does a lot of good things, but those guys are just so difficult to evaluate. But they can change a game. I mean, right now, Taco's got a little ways to go. He always brings the ball down when he catches it. He picks up fouls at an incredible rate. But he's 7'5". He moves pretty well, and he catches it. And he'll dunk it, and he has a decent touch. I mean, there's a lot to like there, and you can be a game changer at 7'5" just by being 7'5". So we'll see. And then, you know, with Raymond Spalding, I kind of thought he'd commit to Louisville like before Rick Pitino got done offering him. Clearly that didn't happen. So it's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. I mean, Kipper Nichols, they're really in there good with. You know, and they're going to expand their net a little bit in July. I think they're going to look at some new guys and just kind of see what's going on and hope a few things fall their way.
I think you mentioned July, obviously the second evaluation period for coaches. They had one in April. There's another one coming up here in the next couple of weeks in July. Snow, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that this July evaluation period is kind of going to be huge for XU staff regarding the 2016 class. I mean, you mentioned they'll probably cast a little bit wider than that in 2015, try to bring a few more guys in, but with only having you know, a couple scholarships in that class, I would imagine that we're going to get a much better feel for 2016 after this July evaluation period. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think 2016 is what the staff, I don't want to say they're focused on 2016, but 2015 is a smaller class. There's six guys in front of them. 2016, that's the next big class for Xavier. And I think that's what the staff is really going to spend a lot of time on in July, is figuring out who is their top guys and who they're really, really going to press on.
Some of the top guys right now that Xavier's already offered and has kind of been recruiting a little bit longer than maybe some of these other names that we'll hear pop up soon. A lot of Midwest guys, especially Ohio, King James specifically has a couple guys in a point guard, Xavier Simpson, center Derek Funderburk, who we've had a lot of stories up on the site about, and an athletic forward in Derek Daniels. And you know, Derek Daniels was at their team camp Another pair of forwards from Ohio, Seth Towns and Matthew Moyer, were both at their team camp and have offers already. So I think those, I mean, there's going to be a lot of kind of local guys. Joey Brunk, a 6'10", really skilled center from Indiana. A lot of kind of local guys in that 2016 class that I think are going to be high priority targets for the staff.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, it's a tremendous class in Ohio. And just as important with that is Ohio State can only take maybe two in that class. And Ohio State's going to have a ton of front court kids already on the roster. And most of the talent in Ohio is all front court kids. So it really leaves it wide open for a lot of the school, for a lot of kids that usually you would pencil in at Ohio State. And, you know, Michigan, Michigan State, Xavier, you know, you're really Cincinnati, you're really going to see those schools try to take advantage.
All right. Well, that kind of wraps up the recruiting. Just last week, Samaje Christen, of course, was drafted. If you kind of were confused with what happened there, there was a lot of confusion on Twitter and people not picking up on what was going on. He was picked by Charlotte after an earlier trade that had sent Shabazz Napier to the Heat in exchange for the extra pick. The Hornets then traded him to the Thunder for cash. So he's now with Oklahoma City. Guys, kind of initial thoughts on him drafted to Oklahoma City. Mine was that there's no immediate opportunity for playing time, but Samaje being picked where he was picked probably wasn't going to get that luxury anyways. I think this opportunity is, at least there is an opportunity, I guess is the best way to put it. I think, you know, they're in a situation, Oklahoma City that is, where they don't know what the future of their backcourt is because Reggie Jackson played really well in the second half of this past NBA season, and he's only under contract for another year. So there's a chance that they may either package him in a trade deal or not be able to re-sign him the following year, which he's kind of, after Russell Westbrook, the go-to ball handler on the team, the next point guard in line. Samaje, I think, has an opportunity to make this roster or at least hang around in the D-League and maybe get a couple call-ups throughout the year if he can prove that he's a worthy insurance option to Reggie Jackson.
I think that I'm glad that Samaje did get drafted when that second round started up. I was starting to get a little concerned, but I'm glad he got drafted. You know, he got shuffled around a little bit, but he ended up in a successful organization, obviously, that has a but that as you say, he's going to be kind of blocked, especially at the point guard position, for the foreseeable future because Russell Westbrook ain't going anywhere. So you know, maybe it's an opportunity for him to learn. And as you say, if he can make the roster out of training camp as a you know, a fifth guard or maybe the backup point guard, he'll have an opportunity to at least get some playing time, get his feet wet, and hopefully set up a foundation for a successful and long NBA career. I mean, I always think, you know, I remember watching – I used to live out west, and I remember watching Ramon Sessions a lot at Nevada. And, I mean – Samaje is better at everything. As a college player, Samaje Christen was better at everything than Ramon Sessions was when he was at UNR. And so I don't see why, if Samaje doesn't get the right opportunities and end up on the right roster, the right coach, the right situation, that he can't have a good long NBA career.
Yeah, I mean, he's got all the ability to be a great NBA player. He just has to become one. And Samaje hasn't always made the best decisions on how to be the best player in the past. So, you know, you're just going to have to he's going to have to battle. And what's interesting with Samaje is he's a kid. I don't know if he can go to Europe. I doubt he can make the Thunder. Is he going to want to play in the D League? It's going to be real interesting to see how Samaje handles these next, you know, 8 to 12 months.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the key for Samaje. Isn't so much what happens on the court, but what happens when he doesn't make the roster. And I mean, my guess is that he spends some time in the D League. I would think that they'll think enough of him to send him there and keep him in case someone gets hurt or whatever to bring him back. But I can't see him going to Europe and succeeding. Just because he's scared to death to leave Cincinnati. I can't imagine him going overseas and playing. So I do agree that that's kind of going to be the most interesting thing is if he doesn't make the roster, what does he do? Now, if for some reason he really catches on and plays great and kind of finds a role somehow for Oklahoma City, whether it's this year, next year, it does become kind of interesting because you sort of look at Russell Westbrook and the freedoms that Scott Brooks gives a point guard to attack and play in transition and play fast and take a lot of shots. And it kind of does seem seem to fit the style that Samaje would like to play as a point guard. The only thing that concerns me is they really needed to upgrade their outside shooting in the backcourt. They don't really have a guard that they could pair with him that could shoot the ball. So long term, I don't know that the Thunder is, if it's the right roster for him or not. But right now, as it concerns Samaje, he just needs to focus on making a roster, and that's going to be a big challenge for him.
All right, fellas. Well, today is July the 1st, 2014. It's actually the one-year anniversary of Xavier entering the Big East Conference, so kind of officially, I guess, so kind of a milestone day as far as that goes. Rick, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, it's also NBA start of NBA free agency last night at midnight. So one other final bit of Xavier news. Golden State did not extend a qualifying offer to Jordan Crawford, which means he is now an unrestricted free agent. He averaged 8.4 points and 1.4 assists in 42 games last year. He also had 41 points in a game against Denver. He could re-sign with Golden State. That's still an option, re-sign for less money, but it's he's going to be out on the open market, and we'll see what he fetches from other teams.
The list of desirable free agents is 1, LeBron James, 1A, Jordan Crawford.
Exactly. I do. Snow, you weren't here for this, but we made NBA Finals predictions, and I do just have to go back to this. This was pretty impressive right here.
Who do you got in the NBA Finals?
It's
2-1 Spurs right now, obviously, after game 3.
I think the Spurs are going to win.
In how many games?
Okay, I'm gonna go crazy here. They're winning 5.
Whoa.
I actually think that last night the tendency will be for people to think that Miami will come out and completely obliterate them in game 4. But I honestly think that this San Antonio team is kind of unflappable. And yeah, they played out of their minds last night in game 3, but I mean, it honestly wouldn't surprise me to see them put the foot on the throat in Miami in game 4. I think they're going to win the next 2.
Dan, you got a prediction for the Reds now or what? I mean, that was pretty damn good.
Well, the Reds have been playing well. I think I'm sticking with my original prediction on the Reds, which is over 500, but miss the playoffs. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that NBA Finals, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a team play as that. The game 3 performance by the Spurs was completely off the charts. I mean, they shot like 88% from the field in the first half of that game. I mean, you're not going to see that time and time again, but it wasn't like, yeah, the percentage was ridiculous, but the shots they were getting were really good, and they were getting such great. They had their second unit with Mills and Splitter and all those guys had such great confidence and were executing so well that they just didn't really miss a beat. And especially, I think it was in the 5th game when San Antonio Miami came out and went up like 15 in the first quarter, and the Spurs just really were kind of unflappable. They just came right back. They got it within a possession or two at halftime, and then they ran them off the floor in the second half. So it was an impressive thing. It'll be interesting to see if they can do it, if they can keep it going next year. I know that Duncan is back for one last go around. So see if they go for a 6th title. But yeah, that was pretty impressive. That's as good of a 3 consecutive games of basketball that I think I've ever seen an NBA team play in a playoff situation.
The thing about that was it just became so clear how much better the Spurs top 6 were compared to the Heat's top 6 or top 7. I mean, after the LeBron James thing, I mean, it was not even close, the talent between those secondary players of the Spurs and the secondary players of the Heat.
Everyone talks about like the Heat's big 3. It's a big 1, a really good 2, and then a 3rd who used to be really good.
Yeah, and like even Chris Bosh, I'm assuming, is the really good 2. Is, I mean, what, probably maybe top 5, but probably more like top 7 at his position.
Yeah, I mean, like
they're neither Wade or Bosh are really top 5 guys at their position. So people get all up in arms about the big 3, but it's ever since the first year they were together, it's really never been that way.
No, it's been the big 1.
So, and then let me ask you guys this. It looks like LeBron James will be re-signing with the Heat. They've all opted out, assuming those guys wouldn't, D-Wade and Udonis Haslem and Chris Bosh wouldn't all opt out unless they had some type of guarantee that LeBron James would be coming back. Does it bother you if the Heat acquire Melo?
Why would it bother me?
That's what I'm asking. It doesn't bother me at all, but everyone is all up in arms about them possibly adding another superstar. I don't understand. I don't understand why people don't like seeing good teams play. When Jordan's Bulls won 72 games, that was fun as hell to watch.
Not to mention, can we talk about how far over the salary cap that team would be now? That team would have 0% chance of existing.
Yes. That is definitely true. I mean, that was a different era.
They paid Jordan like $45 million, didn't they?
Yeah, like zero is on the high level of the percent chance that could exist.
Yeah, it always cracks me up, the revisionist history, but I just don't understand what bothers people about athletes wanting to join up for the better cause, even if it requires taking less money to win. Why do people get upset with that?
I think it's a psychological thing, Rick, to be perfectly honest. I think it's kind of a view that this is one of the first times in American sports. And I can't speak to whether this has happened other places, but that the athletes have kind of run the show in terms of putting together a quote super team. And, you know, maybe there was some collusion with Pat Riley and so forth, which would probably be very illegal under the NBA regulations. But I think people just kind of have a problem with that. But I mean, by the same token, it makes for compelling basketball. I wouldn't watch nearly as much of the NBA playoffs over the last 3-4 years if it wasn't for having, you know, Darth Vader to root against. And I like LeBron. I mean, I actively rooted for LeBron when LeBron was with Cleveland, but for whatever reason, I just enjoy watching these David teams, although the Spurs not that way, but these David teams take name at Goliath in the NBA playoffs, whether it be the Pacers or who they play early this year that gave them a run. The Nets. Well,
their,
you know, any
$50 million payroll.
Exactly. And that's why it's so strange is that those teams are just as doped up financially. I mean, Mikhail Prokhorov is sparing no expense, although I don't know that he knows what he's doing. So I don't know. I think it would definitely make the NBA a little bit more interesting than it already would be if Melo went to the Heat. But I don't know if it, you know, does it make them. I have trouble because at the end of the day, they're still going to get run off the floor when their second unit's on the court.
For the thing is, for me, Melo, the Heat and playing with LeBron would be the perfect fit for Melo's career because Melo is a volume shooter who needs to do what he does offensively, but he's never wanted to be the best player on his team. He's never had that type of game. And I think if you pair him with someone who's so unselfish like LeBron, someone who could actually make him better and would be okay. We understand LeBron's not necessarily the guy that always wants to be the one taking the shot. Now he will. It's overblown how he shrinks away from the moment or whatever, because he comes up big in the moment all the time. But I think it's clear that he would be just fine with having a go-to scoring option like Melo on his team to defer to at times. I think it would be the best thing that ever happened to Carmelo. I don't know if it's the best thing for the Heat, but I think it would be great for his career.
I still think long-term LeBron's best play is to go back to Cleveland.
I do too.
Andrew Wiggins, who's going to be cheap for the next 3 years, Kyrie Irving on a multi-year or on a max deal, but not one that's as ridiculous as the current max deals of the guys like LeBron, Wade and Bosh have.
And spring a deal for Kevin Love. And then you've got something real interesting.
Take that out of the equation. In 2 years, if you have LeBron James and Andrew Wiggins as your two wings, Kyrie Irving as your point guard, Tristan Thompson as your four, and just some center to eat space,
pretty good.
You might have three of the 15 best players in the game.
Well, you're so elite defensively, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think it would be a great fit. I just don't see it. I really feel like he's going to re-sign with the Heat after those other guys opted out. I can't see them doing that.
LeBron has laid down the ultimate gangster play right now. He has said to Pat Riley, in essence, I'm going to Brazil for a week. I'm going to watch soccer. You got a week to figure your stuff out. You know what it's going to take to get me. You figure it out. I'll come back. If not, peace. It's really been that simple.
I agree with you, but I just don't see Dwayne Wade ever turning down the type of money he was about to get and being this unselfish if he didn't have some type of guarantee from LeBron that LeBron was coming back. I find it hard to believe that that Dwayne Wade would ever give up what was 2 years, $42 million that he was owed, because he's not getting that money now. I mean, when he re-signs, he won't be able to get that type of money. So I can't believe he would give up that money if LeBron didn't guarantee him that he was coming back. I agree with you. If he goes away, now he's holding everyone hostage right now. I mean, the Heat, the guys on his team, even the rest of the NBA free agency, because everyone's afraid to make a deal until he decides what he's going to do. I mean, he is absolutely pulling the most gangster move on the NBA. I just can't see it resulting in anything else but him ending up back at Miami, unfortunately.
All right, Snow, we'll give you the last word, and then we'll call time today.
Let's talk about our beloved Cincinnati Reds.
We talked about them last week, Dan. We said, look, if none of the thing or a lot of the things that we were hoping for this team to go right have gone right to this point, what has gone completely wrong is all the things that we counted on being there. Things like Joey Votto and Jay Bruce. They're starting to get healthy, although Votto's not Votto yet. Bruce is coming back to life a little bit. Billy Hamilton has caught fire and is exceeding anything we expected out of him. This team is starting to look like what we hoped they could be before the season started. Does it make you more optimistic now about their chances for the postseason?
It does, but my concern is Joey Votto is slugging like Ray Olmedo right now. And I don't see that changing. And at some point in time, much like the pitchers did last August, they're just going to say, this dude can't hit a fastball middle in. And he's going to stop walking. And when he stops walking, he stops producing. And that's a major issue.
That's right. Right now, he's basically Scott Hatterberg right now.
Well, and I think his upside right now is Sean Casey. That's the problem. He's Scott Hatterberg with the upside of Sean Casey, because even if he comes back, I don't see any power out of him.
I think that they need to do some real soul searching about where his knee is and what needs to happen to get it back to 100%. Because as much as people in town would raise all kinds of hell if they decided, you know what, we got to shut this guy down, we got to get this thing right, you're also looking at 8-9 more years that you've got him on your payroll with a significant piece of that pie.
213 more million.
Right.
213. By the way, that's a deal you can never sign in the Cincinnati market ever. And they did it, and it was dumb at the time. It's even worse now.
And the thing is that – oh, go ahead, Snow. I'm sorry.
Then you combine it with the mishandling of Chapman, and I don't mean making him a reliever. Who's to say he'd be a good starter? But you signed Sean Marshall to a closer money saying Chapman's going to be my starter.
Right. Then you jerk him around.
Then you say, all right, Marshall can't close. We're going to sign Broxton to closer money because Chapman's going to be a starter. Well, then you decide, nope, Chapman's not a starter. You're paying $23 million for the last 9 outs. One of the dudes can't even pitch and may never pitch again.
Mm-hmm.
Problem.
That's problem. All I have to say about that. In terms of this year, though, Rick, I would say that, like I said, I think they need to sit down and they need to really think hard about especially if they fall a little bit more out of the race. If they're still in it, I don't see them shutting Votto down. I just don't think Bob Castellini is the type of guy. I was listening to C-Trent's podcast. He was doing an interview with Mo Egger about this, and they were talking about how Bob Castellini is an optimist. He is just an optimistic guy. And so, like, when they were talking about what the plan was going into this year, it was all kind of pie-in-the-sky stuff. I mean, they kind of just said, no, we'll assume Hamilton can fill in for Chu. Actually, that's kind of happened. We'll assume this happens. I don't think you can make assumptions about Votto's knee at this point. And if I'm them, and you know, maybe I can bring Adam Dunn back for peanuts and have him stand at first base and produce on base percentage and occasionally hit the ball out of the ballpark and maybe get Votto more rest, if nothing else, that's something I'd have to think about.
Absolutely. But, and can we talk about how big of a butcher Votto is at first base right now? You're not losing anything defensively either.
Right. And it would be a nice – I mean, and also I was always a huge Adam Dunn fan, so I'd love to see him come back, hit a few dingers for the Reds. But it seems like something's there because, of course, White Sox have Abreu sitting on first base. He isn't going anywhere. And that's a team that's struggling, and they probably would get rid of him just for the salary relief. So that would also, not for nothing, the Reds have 8 road interleague games in the second half where they're going to need a DH. And I would prefer that DH not be Roger Bernardina. So anyway, guys, I think that probably calls time on this 53rd Ryan Caldwell edition, Rick.
That's right. The Ryan Caldwell edition. The big fella. We appreciate the big fella joining us on the Dana Victory podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and Brian Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.